Yeah, it's a big long chapter with lots of stuff. So I will cover some aspects of it and I will skip other aspects. But it's an interesting chapter. I don't want to completely throw it out of the course. The idea that I wanted to communicate in this chapter is that monetary incentives do not always result in the consequences that their architects expect. Surprise, surprise. But it is surprising, right? So, we began this course by observing that incentives, monetary incentives, are not really practiced in all firms and for all people. So theoretically, incentives are a great idea, right? So you have the incentives increasing marginal effort through the incentive effect. So if you want economy to operate better, you have to introduce monetary incentives. If firms want to maximize profits, they have to incentivize the hell out of their employees. Well, guess what? Not all firms do that. And the firms that do that offer incentives that one would find actually pretty small. Look at our bakeries, right? The average increase in the salary of the incentivized worker was 4%. And that when you receive the bonus, right? When you don't receive the bonus, your salary remains the same. What I'm trying to say, I guess, is the question is why is it so that not all firms offer super strong incentives to their workers? Now, parts of the answer we already have gone through, namely that people are risk averse, yes, and risk aversion reduces the strengths of incentives. We know that from the previous lectures. Next time we meet, we will learn that there is a separate process with lots of interesting strategic implications, a separate process of performance measurement that is required to be there and to correspond to the incentive schemes very closely. So the success or failure of incentive schemes also depends not only on the personal characteristics of people, but also on how well you can measure performance. And sometimes you cannot measure performance, so no incentives. We'll study that next time. But what I want to tell today is that monetary incentives sometimes fail because they bring unintended consequences. Now, what are the unintended consequences? Unintended consequences are, well, as the term suggests, the consequences that were not meant to happen, right? So you want your workers to work harder as a result of the incentives, and they work less hard. Maybe they work hard, but you want your workers to achieve more as a result of incentives, but they achieve less, right? Like these guys, Bandiera, Barankai, and Rasul. They wanted rank incentives to stir up people's performance, but in fact, performance fell down. That's unintended, right? You don't design an incentive scheme to fail people or firms. So that's one aspect of unintended consequences. When you introduce incentives, you expect people to do the right thing, but sometimes people do the wrong thing. Remember the Hanoi rats example, right? You introduce incentives, you expect people to start killing rats. Instead, they start breeding rats and cutting off their tails and selling them to the colonial authorities, right? So in this sense, we're talking about choking under pressure, which is a psychological mechanism that results in performance failures rather than performance gains under incentives. And we will also be talking about dysfunctional behavioral responses, the unintended behavioral consequences of incentives that sometimes come together with the positive consequences of monetary incentives. Now, what are the dysfunctional behavioral responses? They are fraud, trying to game the system, selling rat's tails instead of dead rats in Hanoi, or sabotage, when in order to win a competition, you instead of working hard, you sabotage other people with whom you compete so that you would look better in comparison to them. Have you watched this movie by Dan Aronofsky called Black Swan? No? No? So check it out. There's plenty of sabotage. There's ballet dancers, and they put glass in each other's dancing shoes, and it's uncomfortable to dance with glass in your shoes. So yeah. So So you get sabotage, you get fraud, you get choking under pressure. Let's start with choking under pressure. Now, what is choking? Do you know what choking is? That's what choking is, right? So, and choking under pressure is when your performance, it's a psychological mechanism which is known for at least 120 years, if not more, known in psychological science. So it's pretty authoritative result, right? It's no fraud. So here is the so-called Yerkes-Dodson law. It says that when incentives are low, well, it's an old-fashioned term. Now it means something different, but we're talking about 120 years ago. So when incentives are low, performance is weak because people are not excited. They're not aroused. Yeah. So when incentives get stronger, performance improves. So far, so good. The classical model of incentives, you can look at the first order condition and the agent problem. The classical model of incentives implies that as incentives get stronger and stronger, effort gets higher and higher, and performance gets better and better. Yerkes-Dodson law says that there is actually an optimum level of incentive in terms of the optimal performance that it can produce. Why? Because past this level of incentives, when incentives are too strong, you get impaired performance because of strong anxiety. So that's your choking under pressure, right? So does anybody play a musical instrument here? Is anybody in the orchestra or individual? No? Anybody plays? Okay. So I like to play guitar and I like to play piano, right? So but when I play in public, I get very, very anxious. And when I play in public, I play a lot worse than I play alone. Why? You know, you get these sweaty hands, trembling fingers, you can't hit the right key, you speed up, you lose the rhythm. So every problem that can happen does happen with my performance. That's why I don't like to play in public. Because I'm very anxious. The motivation to play for me increases. You know, I don't want to fail in public. It's okay to fail in private, but failing in public is another ball game. And I started, instead of thinking about music, I start thinking about, oh, I have to hit the right key in the right moment. And that creates anxiety. That's your Yerkes-Dodson law, right? Now, a further elaboration on this idea distinguishes between activities that are more cognitively intensive and activities that are less cognitively intensive, right? So the less cognitively intensive activities are some physical, mechanical activities that don't require a high degree of precision or coordination, right? So think about pressing the same button all the time like this. That's a cognitively not intensive activity, right? Playing a musical instrument is cognitively very intensive activity, right? You play with your brain, not with your fingers. So there's a lot of cognitive load on people who play musical instruments or do some high precision sports, right? So now, and Yerkes-Dodson law says that, well, as incentives get stronger and stronger, the performance in not cognitively intensive tasks doesn't really suffer. But what does suffer is the performance in cognitively intensive tasks, which suggests that the biological reason why choking under pressure occurs is because your brain simply gets overloaded with signals, right? So think about a computer. You open one package on it, you go to a website, then you'd want to download a movie, then you want to listen to broadcast, and when you do it all at the same time, the capacity reaches its limit, the fan starts working and it goes, woo, and then it fails, right? So when something similar happens to the brain of a strongly incentivized person, and not everyone can manage that. Now, economic theory doesn't care about cognitive load. Economic theory assumes that everybody is just an algorithmic decision-making automat, right? Which is not true, right? We do face cognitive constraints. Our brains are not limitless. And when the cognitive constraints of our brains are reached, then we start, then our performance starts deteriorating. So that is the idea of the Yerkes-Dodson law. And there is some empirical evidence to that. So here is a paper, a very famous paper actually, called "Large Stakes, Big Mistakes." It's not compulsory reading, but I strongly recommend you have a look. It's a fun to read paper. It's written by economists and psychologists. Dan Ariely, did I tell you about Dan Ariely? Oh, he's a very famous psychologist and a very interesting person. He was a military officer in the Israeli army. So he was a soldier, right? And he had an accident. A very bad accident, burning. So his skin burnt in many places and got disfigured. And of course, he was discharged from the army, and he spent lots of time in hospitals and rehabilitation centers with constant pain all the time. And then he decided to, you know, change career and became an academic, and a very successful academic, I must say. So there aren't a lot of soldiers who became very successful academics, but Dan Ariely is one of them. And so he's on that paper. But he is, of course, very famous for this idea that every work has to have a meaning. But that's not part of compensation and benefits, because compensation and benefits are about cash, not about meaning. Interested to know more about it, come to my Personnel Economics 2 course, where I talk about it in one of the lectures. So lots of empirical evidence on this choking under pressure, and a couple of experiments, which I will go through very briefly. So experiment number one, people were hired to play games, just recreational games, not requiring a lot of skill, right? What varied between treatments is that some people were offered small prizes for winning the game. Other people were offered larger prizes, and yet other people were offered very, very, very large prizes, measuring up to 80% of the average monthly grocery bill, right? So imagine some weird academic from America comes to you and says, would you like to play backgammon with me or darts? And the prize will be, I don't know, 80% of how much you spend on your living costs. Yeah? So that's a nice incentive. And you would expect that people would perform better as incentives get stronger. You would expect, right? But people do not perform better as incentives get stronger, right? So relative to the low incentives, performance is either insignificantly different or is significantly worse when incentives are high, right? Why so? Why do people play less well when incentives are strong? Does it mean that they work less hard? No, I don't think they work less hard. It's just that they are too excited, you know, that they are too serious about playing, and they think about cash or winning cash or not losing cash, and they think about what they will buy should they win the game. As a result, they are more likely to lose and their performance suffers. So not all monetary incentives actually result in strong positive performance outcomes. Choking under pressure is a consideration that we haven't taken into account so far, but it is there. You think it's just academic psychology. Well, think again. So Goldman Sachs, rings a bell? Goldman Sachs firm, yeah? So they have a reputation for a very, very, how you say, For a working culture that requires a lot of effort and highly stressful environment, right? So you have to meet the targets, you have to be in that meeting, and in that meeting you have to go through this performance evaluation and that performance evaluation. You want to take a leave? Seriously, you want to take a leave? That's very unusual, right? So unusual, you'd be surprised. I read it on BBC the other day. So Goldman Sachs introduced a program. You won't believe it. You won't believe it. But check it out. Check it out. They introduced a program to its employees saying, guys, you can take unlimited paid leave. If I were offered unlimited paid leave, that would be the last day you'd see me. Unlimited paid leave. No one took it. They had to remove the program because no one took it, you know. So burnout. You would be interested to know why. Yeah. So why didn't you take the unlimited paid leave, man? If I take unlimited paid leave, my frenemies in my team will take over the projects that I've been running, and they will be promoted in front of me, and they will get a salary increase before me, and they will be made super team leaders, and I will be made junior deputy team leader, right? So you know, this hierarchical crap. People are that married to their jobs in some environments, right? So and of course they freak out, and of course they choke under pressure. And there are any number of people having burnouts, having stress, having mental diseases and other unpleasantries as a result of an unhealthily tough working schedule, right? So choking under pressure is very much an empirical reality of these days. Think about burnout. Right, and not taking it into account is myopic. Now, another experiment that they did was the experiment that they did with MIT students, right? Yeah, MIT students. And again, the idea was, well, let's offer them low payment and high payment. Well, how much is high payment? Well, high payment is up to $300. You know, back in those years, you could rent a room for $300 a month. Right? So it's serious money. You would expect people to work harder. Do they work harder? Yes, they do work harder. But notice that they work harder only on the task that is cognitively not pressing. So there are two tasks that they were asked to do. The first one is key pressing, which is a simple physical task. You should just press the key as many times as possible, and for each pressing of the key, you get some money, right? So and if you press the key super fast, you get this price of up to $300. But then there was a cognitive task, adding numbers, right? And think about it. So the classical economics would predict that both pressing a key and adding numbers would be more. People would do more of both tasks under higher incentives. But actually, look at this cross product. It says, well, the performance in key pressing task, in performance in key pressing task, was 0.34 better when the payment was high relative to when the payment is low. How much better was the performance on the adding task as the incentives moved from high to low? Well, it's this coefficient plus this coefficient, which is minus 22. So performance improved in the cognitively easy task, according to Yorks Dodson. It just improved according to cognitively easy task, but it's deteriorated in the cognitively complicated tasks. Given that a lot of tasks in modern economy are cognitively complicated, and hopefully after this program you will be doing cognitively complicated tasks, not pressing the button all the time, right? So think about it. Yeah, okay, so I'll skip this one. I guess the point is clear. The next observation I want to make, that's my favorite, in some sense. This is a paper published in Academy of Management Discoveries, a very interesting academic journals. But what they did. So welcome to Denmark. Denmark, as well as other Scandinavian countries, have absolutely excellent world-class statistical facilities. If you want to learn about how an average Joe earns and how much an average Joe spends on food, on drugs, pharmacy, I mean, not illegal drugs, right? Go to Denmark. Go to Denmark. They have these data. Unlike Germany, where data protection is very, very serious for a variety of reasons, right? In Scandinavia, they are a lot cooler about merging different databases. So you can actually get, which is what these guys did. They had information on people on 318,000 employees in more than 1,000 Danish firms. So they had a lot of guys working in a lot of firms, okay? From these guys, they had the data on how much they earned in those firms, and that's really beautiful. And they also had information about which practices these Danish firms had, which management practices these Danish firms had. So they had information about wages and management practices in the Danish firms where these guys worked. And they also, from these guys, they had their pharmacy records, right? When you go to pharmacy and buy a prescription drug, a record is made in the system, which is then sent to your health insurance company or something, right? So you know the background, yeah? So look what happens. So the question is, suppose your firm adopts incentive pay. So P4P means pay for performance. So some monetary incentives, right? So you know when a given firm adopted an incentive pay program. And you know which of these guys this incentive pay program affected. And you also know which drugs and when these guys bought. So the question is, what's the effect of the adoption of incentive programs on the purchase of antidepressant and anti-anxiety medications by the guys who work under monetary incentives? Do you know antidepressant and anti-anxiety medications? Yeah, so these are heavy medications that really, you know, it's not your recreational aspirin or paracetamol that it's really, really heavy stuff. And look what happens. When an incentive program and monetary incentives were introduced, the people who worked under these incentives increased their consumption of antidepressant and anti-anxiety medication to cope with the extra stress that monetary incentives bring. You know, monetary incentives increase sales by 44% in Lazier study. Cool. By 22% in Bandiera study. Cool, wow, 22%. Our study with bakery workers, 3% sales. Super cool. Incentives, fantastic. Let's incentivize the hell of the workforce. Never mind. There will be more anxiety, more depression, and more people trying to cope with this using medication or other methods. So you could argue that maybe the effect on maybe this worrying effect is not caused by incentives. Maybe this worrying effect is caused by some other changes in the organization that coincided with the introduction of incentives. For example, a firm could have been bought by another firm, and they would bring in some strategy consultants, and they would say, guys, we need this practice and this practice, we need to reorganize, we need to reshape our operations, somebody will have to go. And of course, this somebody will, before going, will go to the drugstore and buy themselves antidepressant and anti-anxiety medication. So maybe it's not monetary incentives, maybe it's something else that happens together with monetary incentives. Well, Fortunately, they had information about other management practices that these firms used. So interdisciplinary groups, whatever it means, quality groups, employee input, job rotation, delegation, autonomous groups, function integration, teamwork, scaled wages, pay for performance. So lots of practices. And look, the effects of these practices, of all of these practices, are not significantly different from zero. It's only pay for performance, whose effect on prescription drug is significantly different from zero, right? So it's not pay for, it's not other practices. It's the pay for performance, the wonderful incentive effect that we study in this course that is responsible for the uptick in the use of antidepressant drugs by personnel in Danish firms. Something to know, right? You offer incentives, be prepared, there'll be more burnout, and be prepared that some people will freak out. Now, speaking of freaking out, stronger incentives do not necessarily lead to better performance. Yeah, oh, yes. Here's an example. A cutting from BBC News. I read BBC News from time to time. Well, that says it all, right? So, police on the Italian island of Sicily have arrested an ambulance worker suspected of killing people to earn money from a funeral parlor linked to the mafia. So imagine a guy who works in the ambulance, right? So he's a guy working in the ambulance. There's some critical case. So a person in the critical condition needs to be taken to a hospital. And well, the guy who drives the ambulance car or is the doctor in the ambulance car has friends in the funeral business. And the friends in the funeral business says, you know, if there are, you know, freshly dead people, maybe you could give me their addresses that we can call families and offer our services. And if they buy these services, you get some, you get some bonus from us. It's a piece rate incentive scheme. No targets, just piece rate incentive scheme, right? So, okay. So up to, so he's said to have been paid 300 euros for each corpse. Now, how can you, you drive your ambulance car and sometimes people die on the way to hospital, yeah? So, and then you get your 300 euros. But you know, 300 euros, and this person whom I'm supposed to take to the hospital, maybe I should expedite his departure and get 300 euros extra, right? That's what happens. So, police arrested the man after a contact said to be a reformed mafia member who gave details to authorities in the city of Catania and to an investigative TV program. The ambulance worker is charged with voluntary homicide. It is alleged that the suspect injected air into the veins of patients, causing them to die of an embolism as they were being transported back to the small town, whatever, right? So all you do is to give them a little bit of air in the veins. It will not be detected. The person will die because if you inject air in the veins, your heart will fail, right? So an extra 300 euros, you know, nice restaurant dinner or, you know, plus a taxi home. Fantastic. Just a little bit of air in the veins. So incentives can not only lead people to choking out, incentives can also lead people to doing something horrible, like in this example. I had a bachelor student who wrote a bachelor thesis some years ago, maybe I should incorporate it in my course, where he actually went to look for criminal cases of medical malpractice in Germany, right? So when doctors were, for example, you know, would prescribe wrong treatments to people without medical need, but these treatments would be, you know, high value treatments for which the doctors could get high honorarium, right? There weren't a lot of such cases, thankfully, so my faith in the German medical system is not undermined, but bad incentives, the dysfunctional behavioral responses from incentives are there. and need to be taken into account. Now, how do you take it into account? Easier said than done, right? So how could you have prevented this from happening? How could you have prevented this from happening, right? So very hard to prevent this from happening. Maybe the cheaper option would be not to offer incentives. Yes, people will work less hard, but they will buy less antidepressant drugs. They will be sick with burnout fewer days, so your total costs on your employees will actually be lower without incentives than with incentives. Yeah, so maybe that's why many firms are reluctant to practice incentives, because they have a lot of unintended consequences. Some of them can be quite horrible. Now, need I reflect on the events in the corporate world that led to the financial crisis of the year 2008? Well, it was before your time, but you probably remember, right? 2008, it was a big financial crisis. How did it start?
I think with the failure of the banking system, right? When they offered the loans and then...
That's right. Subprime mortgage market. So, subprime mortgage market. You come to a bank and say, look, I want to buy a flat. Does anybody have a mortgage here? I have a mortgage. So you come to a bank and say, I want to buy a flat. The bank says, okay, send me this document and this document and that document and the other document. And then you get an offer for a loan at a given interest rate, etc., right? And then the berater, the person who authorized the loan for you, gets a commission from the bank. And so it is in the interest of the bank to issue loans to people, because the individual consultants to issue loans, because each time they issue a loan, there will be a commission for them. So when I come to a bank to get a loan, I get a loan. Well, I am a relatively low risk person, right? I am not old yet. I have a safe job. I have a good income. So a kind of pillar of the community in a sense, right? So banks like guys like me. But suppose I wouldn't have permanent jobs. Suppose I would be, you know, in and out of jobs or some kind of freelancer, right? So I would come to the bank and say, and the bank says, oh, sorry, you don't have a permanent job. We can't give you a loan. And say, I really, you know, we could help each other. We could help each other. I want a loan to buy a flat and you want a commission for this loan. You know, maybe let's be creative about how we prove that I have a permanent job. Let's, I don't know, write a fake letter of employment and you will put a blind eye to it and say that this is a genuine letter. And who knows, it will be, you know, inspections are not 100%, right? So you'll give me the loan and okay. The clerk gives you the loan, you get the loan, you buy the flat, but because you don't have permanent income, you have intermittent income, at some point you find it hard to pay your mortgage, and what you do at some point is you default on your mortgage. Now, okay, you default on your mortgage, that's really bad news for the bank. The bank is not a real estate agency, so the bank will typically sell these houses at a very, very big discount, so it's a loss for the bank. Where is the berater who issued this mortgage? Oh, he's gone to another bank or went into retirement and it's limited liability anyway. So the berater is gone. The bank is facing a loss, right? If this is one-off, if this is just, you know, a couple of cases every now and then, that's okay. But if it's massive, like it was in subprime mortgage market in America, that actually led to a financial crisis worldwide. You know, so incentives can backfire and result in massive performance losses, not necessarily performance gains. I also wanted to talk about fraud and sabotage, but I think these points are pretty self explanatory, right? So to summarize this little lecture on unintended consequences of incentives, the points I wanted to make are these. Economic theory assumes that there's no such thing as too strong incentives, because each time we discussed efficiency aspect of incentive schemes, we said incentives are too weak, incentives are too weak, incentives are too weak, the effort is below efficient level. Let's think about performance targets to make incentives stronger, to move the effort to tick up towards the efficient level. Actually, the psychology says that incentives may be too strong because of choking under pressure, especially in cognitively difficult tasks, when people's cognitive abilities reach their limits, and despite putting in high amount of effort, people's performance suffers because of the cognitive deficit. Another meaning in which incentives may be too strong is that incentives may result in dysfunctional behavioral responses, such as fraud, sabotage, gaming the system, which may quickly evolve into highly criminal and damaging behaviors. So the consequences of incentives are unintended, but firms who practice incentives, they anticipate them, and I would say they anticipate them even better than we academics with our formulas and models. This is a possible reason why not all firms practice incentives. So compensation and benefits is largely about incentives. So look, we talk about incentives this and incentives that. Incentive is super important. But compensation and benefits is not only about incentives, right? So it's also about other ways to motivate people and manage compensation and benefits budgets to the best performance result for the entire organization. So that's the end of this lecture. And next time we will be talking about performance measurement and evaluation. One lecture theory, one lecture practice. Thank you. See you later today.